This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Good morning. It's May 8th. I'm Trip Eldridge, and this is the Washington Post. With me, Bill Machuga and Greg Nock. Here are the front page stories we'll be covering. Daniels delivers fraud account of Trump encounter, elicits anger from president, and alarmed judge warns defense about behavior. In New York and D.C., scenes from a surreal campaign. Plans developed to muscle up for a global trade war. Trump advisors explore legal theories to justify a new universal tariff. How the call to ban cell phones went through one school. Four-color photo of a teacher and a student and a phone. TikTok sues over U.S. law that could ban the app. Cites First Amendment in the case that could prove to be an existential fight. And Israeli troops capture Rafah crossing. Incursion disrupts aid delivery, sends civilians fleeing by thousands. And we'll start with that story. It's by Loveday Morris, Hibra Fauk Maluz, Claire Parker, Shira Rubin, and Harjar Harb. Israeli forces seized control of the Rafah border crossing in the southern Gaza Strip on Tuesday, shutting down the flow of aid and sending thousands of civilians fleeing as they opened a new front in the months-long war to eradicate Hamas from the territory. In a statement, the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, said it had gained operational control of the Palestinian side of the crossing as part of a precise counterterrorism operation in Rafah, which shares a border with Egypt. The incursion Tuesday appeared limited, falling short of a large-scale ground offensive Israel had threatened in Rafah, but it also shut down the crossing, a key entry point for aid to southern Gaza, triggering immediate concern over the delivery of food, fuel, and other supplies to Palestinians displaced by war. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for the crossings to be reopened immediately, urging Israel to stop any escalation and engage in diplomacy. Israel communicated to the United States that its activity in Rafah, which began Monday night, is an operation of limited scope, scale, and duration, and aimed at cutting off Hamas's ability to ship arms across the Rafah border, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said at a news briefing yesterday. He said it was absolutely critical that Israel allow the crossing to be opened as soon as possible. Several videos and photographs geolocated by the Washington Post Tuesday showed Israeli Defense Forces inside the crossing where they had raised two Israeli flags. One video showed an Israeli tank crushing an I love Gaza sign that welcomes visitors. The operation to take Rafah crossing came less than 24 hours after the IDF dropped leaflets over the city ordering more than 100,000 citizens to leave large parts of it. The U.S. has urged Israel not to carry out an offensive in Rafah without a credible plan to evacuate civilians. Egypt has also repeatedly warned Israel not to go ahead with a Rafah operation. It said military action on the border could violate a four-decade-old peace treaty between the two countries. The Egyptian foreign ministry described the incursion as a dangerous escalation that was threatening the ceasefire effort and endangering the lives of millions of Palestinians who depend on the crossing for humanitarian aid and a safe way out for the injured and patients to get treatment. Cairo has specifically warned against any Israeli move to secure the no man's land between Gaza and Egypt, known as the Philadelphia Corridor, a 9-mile-long stretch that Israel controlled before it withdrew in 2005. But Israel seems intent on pressuring Hamas while giving its leverage as it negotiates with the group to free hostages kidnapped on October 7th, just hours before the incursion. Hamas said it would agree to a Qatar Egyptian ceasefire proposal, reviving hopes of an extended pause in the fighting. This operation will continue until we eliminate Hamas in the Rafah area and the entire Gaza Strip, or until the first hostage returns, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said Tuesday as he visited troops in southern Israel. We're willing to make compromises in order to bring back hostages, but if that option is removed, we'll go on and deepen the operation, he said. The IDF said Tuesday that it attacked and destroyed Hamas infrastructure in Rafah, including tunnels that it said militants had used. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of using the ceasefire talks to undermine our entry into Rafah. That didn't happen, Netanyahu said Tuesday, adding that he was sending a mid-level delegation to Cairo to attend a fresh round of talks. Under discussion is a three-phase deal that would start with the release by Hamas of 33 hostages, including women, children, and the elderly, in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. It also includes provisions for the return of displaced Palestinians to northern Gaza and for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from populated areas. The ball is in Netanyahu's court and that of his extremist government, Osama Hamdan, a senior Hamas official in Beirut, said at a Tuesday conference. Israeli officials said Hamas agreed to a modified proposal that Israel had not signed off on. Among the changes was an earlier date for the two sides to begin negotiating a permanent ceasefire. Hamas also wants Israel to give up its veto power over the names of high-level Palestinian prisoners, according to an Israeli official. A former Egyptian official who, with knowledge of the talks, however, said the proposal Hamas accepted was approved by the Israeli government. And according to Gershon Baskin, a former Israeli negotiator, the two sides won't agree to a deal because they want fundamentally different things. Hamas wants an agreement that includes a guarantee for permanent ceasefire. Netanyahu wants to be able to keep fighting the war and won't agree to a deal that ends the conflict. That's where we're trapped, he said. The back and forth between Israel and Hamas caused fear and confusion in Rafah. On Monday, residents celebrated the Hamas announcement, saying it had accepted the deal, but hours later, the jubilation was cut short by intense Israeli bombing and fighting at the Rafah crossing. It would be tragic if weeks of intense diplomatic activity for peace in Gaza yield no ceasefire, no release of hostages, and a devastating offensive in Rafah, Gutierrez said. Over 7 months of war, Rafah served as the last refuge for Palestinians, with tents and makeshift encampments choking its dusty streets and open areas. On Tuesday, thousands crammed the roads to leave, though there was little transport or fuel available, said Nebil Farkas, a spokeswoman for the Palestinian Crescent Society. There's no way to evacuate this number of people safely, she said, adding that people had scant notice to evacuate before the bombardment began. The IDF said that the vast majority of more than 100,000 citizens in the evacuation zone had already left the area, but many people reached in Rafah said they didn't have the means to leave. Aid groups also warned that Mawasi region, that the IDF has suggested as a safe zone, is poorly equipped to handle a major influx of people. There's going to be no infrastructure for those people to share, said Ricardo Pires, a spokesman for UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency. Marwan Alhams, director of the Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in eastern Rafah, said Tuesday that staff were shutting down the building because of the fighting. Every moving person is a target, he said. Hada Lafi, 43-year-old, who lives with his disabled parents and around 40 members of extended family in a house in Rafah's Al-Janira neighborhood, he said he didn't follow the orders to evacuate because there's nowhere else to go. We did not move, not because we don't want to, but because the most important question is where, he said, doubting that they could even find a space to pitch a tent. Abir Mar, a 36-year-old mother of three who was displaced from Gaza's city's Rimmel neighborhood earlier in the war and fled to Rafah, said transportation costs made it impossible for many to leave. A car to the southern city of Khan Yunis cost more than $300, she said. I'm seriously terrified, she said, adding that bombing in Rafah had kept the family up all night. Many people left on foot, she said, bundling their belongings into bags or carts. Muaz Alams, a 23-year-old, said his uncle, aunt, and two cousins had been killed in the bombardment overnight. We're facing darker and worse days than we can imagine, he said. People see death everywhere. Stormy Daniels testifies and Trump curses in an angry day in court. Devlin Barrett, Dom Chakman, Shana Jacobs, and Marianne Levine with this story. Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress at the center of Donald Trump's hush money trial, testified yesterday about a disturbing sexual encounter she says she had with him, leading to angry, profane muttering from the former president that alarmed the judge. New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchant called Trump's lawyer Todd Blanche to a sidebar during a midday break to say that Trump was cursing audibly and possibly intimidating Daniels, who had begun testifying, according to a trial transcript. "I understand that your client is upset at this point," Merchant said to the defense attorney, according to his transcript, "but he is cursing audibly and he is shaking his head visually, and that's contemptuous. It has the potential to intimidate the witness, and the jury can see that." Blanche assured the judge he would speak to Trump. "I'm speaking to you here at the bench because I don't want to embarrass him," Merchant said. "You need to speak to him. I won't tolerate it." The exchange punctuated a day of rage, sometimes whispered from the defense table, sometimes declared loudly by Daniels from the witness stand. It was one of the surreal moments of the 13th day of the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president, including descriptions by Daniels of their alleged sexual encounter in 2006 that were so detailed that defense attorneys demanded a mistrial. While Merchant rejected their request, Daniels at times seemed to be describing a non-consensual sex that could be considered highly prejudicial for the jury, which in turn could give Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, solid grounds to appeal if he's found guilty. Trump is accused of 34 counts of falsifying business records for allegedly disguising financial transactions related to a $130,000 hush money payment made to Daniels in 2016 to keep her quiet about what she said happened between them. He's denied the charges and denied having sex with Daniels. Speaking rapidly and often emphasizing her answers by pointing her finger in the air, Daniels insisted there was nothing about the years of bad blood between her and Trump that made her story untrue. Still, her dislike of the defendant was palpable in the courtroom. Daniels described meeting Trump at a golf event at Lake Tahoe, California, and being invited to his hotel suite that night. When she got there, she talked with the reality TV star for a couple of hours, but then, to her surprise, she emerged from the bathroom to find him wearing a T-shirt and boxers and posing on the bed, Daniels said. "That's when I had that moment when I felt like the room spun in full motion, and I felt the blood leave my hands and my feet, almost like if you stand up too fast," she testified. Trump stood up between me and the door, not in a threatening manner, though she said she felt an imbalance of power, particularly with Trump's security guard outside. "I think I blacked out," Daniels said, adding that there were many details she didn't remember but were insisting she wasn't drugged or drunk. "Next thing I know, I was on the bed," she testified. "I was staring at the ceiling. I didn't know how I got there." She said the encounter was brief. Before Daniels testified, Trump's lawyers had argued that it would be unfair to tell the jury salacious details about an alleged sexual encounter that's not part of the charges against him. Merchant warned prosecutor Susan Hoffinger not to go into great detail about the alleged encounter, but the prosecutor elicited not only a lengthy description of a sexual experience that often didn't sound consensual, but also a raft of other details down to the brand of shampoo in the bathroom, Pert Plus. Trump's lawyers complained bitterly that Daniels' accounts of possible sex crime had hopelessly tainted the jury against him and asked for a mistrial. "All of this has nothing to do with this case, is extraordinarily prejudicial, and the only reason why the government asked those questions, besides pure embarrassment, is to inflame this jury not to look at the evidence that matters," Blanche said. Prosecutors said the jury needed to know the underlying details of Daniels' alleged encounter with Trump to understand why he'd be motivated to pay money to keep it quiet, and the specifics, they said, would boost her credibility after it has been attacked by Trump's lawyers. Merchant rejected the defense request for a mistrial, saying that while Daniels had talked too fast and gone into greater detail than he would like, that was partly the defense fault for not objecting more strenuously. "There are some things that are probably better left unsaid," Merchant said. "I think there were some things that I think the witness was a little difficult to control. It was not easy." The judge defended his own role during the testimony, saying that he had done everything that I can possibly do to protect both sides. Before Daniels was brought back to testify, he instructed the prosecutor to speak to her and make it clear that she needed to speak slower and only answer the questions she was asked. The fight over Daniel's testimony comes weeks after the same prosecutor's office suffered a stinging defeat when New York's highest court tossed out their 2020 conviction of movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, saying the trial judge had improperly allowed too much testimony about uncharged sexual misconduct. In the Trump case, Merchant has insisted that the ruling has no bearing on the current trial. While Tuesday's testimony could give Trump a media appeals issue, should he be convicted, that process typically takes years and would be worth far less politically than a win at trial. Outside the courtroom, Trump told reporters that the day featuring Daniels had blown up in the prosecutor's face. "This was a very big day, a very revealing day, as you see, and they're totally falling apart," he said. "They have nothing on the books and records or even something that should bear even a very little relationship to the case. It's just a disaster for the DA. The whole case is a disaster." Trump's angry demonstrations from the trial table were not the first time he was upset at a trial judge. The federal judge overseeing his civil trial earlier this year threatened to expel him from the courtroom after he audibly disparaged his sexual accuser, Jean Carroll, who successfully sued for defamation. On Tuesday afternoon, Trump lawyer Susan Nikeles charged Daniels shifting accounts of what happened, suggesting she was willing to say whatever got her paid. In 2011, Daniels acknowledged she had tried and failed to sell her story of meeting Trump for $15,000. At times, she publicly denied the two had sex, but on the witness stand, Daniels insisted those were lies, told to live up to the terms of the non-disclosure agreement, which paid her $130,000. Nikeles suggested that the main lesson Daniels learned from the 2011 experience was that she would have to make up a story about having sex with Trump if she wanted to make money. "Am I correct that you hate President Trump and you want him to go to jail, right?" Nikeles asked, pointing to an old social media post where Daniels said she'd dance down the street if you're locked up. "I want him to be held accountable," Daniels replied. "You're looking to extort money from President Trump, right?" the defense lawyer asked. "False," Daniels countered, although she later conceded that she was interested in making money and insisted there was nothing wrong with that. "To be quite honest, if I had a chance to get the story out and make some money, yes," she said. She also acknowledged that as a result of losing some civil cases against Trump and being ordered to pay his legal fees, she owes Trump more than $660,000. Nikeles wondered whether the debt was motivation for Daniels to publicly accuse Trump. Daniels admitted tweeting that she would go to jail before she paid Trump. "You've chosen to disobey a court order?" Nikeles asked Daniels. "I've chosen not to pay," Daniel said. And continuing inside front page story briefly before we give it to Bill. Judge indefinitely delays start to Trump's classified documents trial in Florida, from Perry Stein and Devlin Barrett. Donald Trump's Florida trial for allegedly mishandling classified documents and obstructing government efforts to retrieve them have been pushed back indefinitely, U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon ruled Tuesday, increasing the chance that the former president's ongoing New York criminal trial may be the only one to happen before the November election. The judge had originally set the Florida trial date for late May, but that seemed unlikely for months, with Cannon still needing to make decisions on a number of key legal issues before a jury can hear the case. At a scheduling hearing in Florida on March 1st, Trump's lawyers pushed to start the classified documents trial after the election, in which he's the presumptive Republican nominee. Prosecutors urged Cannon to pick a date in early July. If Trump returns to the Oval Office, he could appoint an attorney general who's willing to drop the federal charges against him. In addition, Justice Department policy forbids the criminal prosecution of a sitting president. In a ruling Tuesday, Cannon said there are many complicated legal rules and deadlines surrounding the use of classified evidence in public criminal trials that need to be considered before she picks a new court date. The order was a blow to Special Counsel Jack Smith and his team, who have argued that Trump's team may have had ample time to prepare for a summer trial and accused Trump's lawyers of wrongly trying to use the three other criminal cases against him as a way to obfuscate and delay the legal proceedings of Florida. Trump's Manhattan trial for allegedly falsifying records related to a hush money payment in mid-April. His lead attorney in New York, Todd Blanche, is also his lead attorney in Florida, and the legal team has told Cannon that the Trump Blanche and Blanche are tied up with the ongoing trial and cannot prepare for the classified documents case. They also have said they're holding any trial too close to the election would amount to election interference, and that if Cannon cannot delay the classified documents case until after November, she should schedule it for August.
Good morning, everyone. This is Bill Machuga, and I will be reading two of the articles for you from the front page of this morning's Washington Post. The first article comes under White House. The headline, Biden and Trump's Day of Contrasts Marks a Surreal Campaign. This is written by Matt Visor. President Biden was in the map room at the White House, going line by line over a speech he would soon deliver commemorating the Holocaust, when a few hundred miles to the north, a prosecutor stood before the court and declared, "The people call Stormy Daniels." Biden would soon visit Capitol Hill to join some of the country's top elected officials in memorializing an atrocity that killed 6 million Jews and to pledge repeatedly, never again. He appeared at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum ceremony at the same moment his predecessor was listening attentively in a courthouse on the 13th day of his hush money trial, where an adult film actress was called to testify about the tawdry details of their alleged encounter. The person who introduced Biden called him a mensch and recalled his surprising attendance at a shiva for his late wife. The person testifying about Trump called him arrogant and pompous and recounted the time he surprisingly appeared in his underwear and purportedly talked her into having sex with him in a Lake Tahoe hotel. If voters needed any further reminder of the surreal nature of the 2024 presidential campaign, it was provided starkly Tuesday. The incumbent president started the day grappling with turmoil in the Middle East and preparing to meet the president of Romania. The challenger began his morning upset over the latest witness in his criminal trial for allegedly falsifying business records. He posted an angry message on social media about the unfairness of it all, which he later deleted. It emerged that Daniels would be testifying and, over objections from Trump's attorneys, would be allowed to go into some detail about their alleged unwanted sexual encounter at a California golf tournament in 2006. She took the stand in the late morning, around the time Biden was making final edits to his Holocaust comments in the map room, where Franklin Roosevelt reviewed the progress of World War II. Daniels testified about meeting Trump and being invited to his hotel room, where she said she initially found him in silk or satin pajamas. Later, when she emerged from the bathroom, she recalled, she was startled to see him on the bed in his boxer shorts and a t-shirt. "I wasn't expecting someone to be there, especially minus a lot of clothing. That's when I had that moment when I felt like the room spun in full motion," she told the court. "And I felt the blood leave my hands and my feet, almost like if you stand up too fast. I just thought, oh my God, what did I misread to get here? Because the intention is pretty clear. Somebody's in their underwear on the bed, posing for you." She wasn't drunk or on drugs, she said, but the details nonetheless remained fuzzy. "Next thing I know, I was on the bed," Daniel said, "the opposite side of the bed from where we'd been standing. I had my clothes and shoes off. We were in missionary position." She testified that, "I was staring at the ceiling. I didn't know how I got there. I was trying to think about anything other than how I got there. At almost the exact same time, Biden was speaking from a podium in Emancipation Hall in the Capitol. It was a bipartisan event with top leaders, including House Speaker Mike Johnson and Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, making remarks before him. The main cable network switched from reports on Trump's trial to carry Biden's address live. Quoting, "We recommit to heeding the lessons that one of the darkest chapters in human history to revitalize and realize the responsibility of never again," Biden said. This ancient hatred of Jews didn't begin with the Holocaust. It didn't end with the Holocaust either, or after, even after our victory in World War II. The president denounced the ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in America and around the world, at a moment when many world leaders and fellow Democrats, and even Biden himself, have questioned some of Israel's tactics in Gaza and the ensuing humanitarian crisis. He focused Tuesday on supporting Israel, comparing those who downplay the October 7 Hamas attacks to people who forget or deny the Holocaust. Now here we are, not 75 years later, but just 7.5 months later, and people are already forgetting, Biden said. They're already forgetting that Hamas unleashed this terror. Around the time that Daniels was testifying about allegedly being threatened not to publicly disclose her encounter with Trump, Biden joined the audience at the Capitol in holding up black and white photos of Holocaust victims. The vivid contrast between the two candidates' daily schedules provides an early snapshot of what is already one of the most unusual campaigns in memory, as a sitting president confronts a challenger who faces 4 criminal trials. Biden has generally been careful to avoid commenting on Trump's trials, while Trump has suggested without evidence that the charges against him are part of a plot. The only incident in recent history that may compare to the distasteful drama surrounding Trump, a former and possibly future president, may be the experience of President Bill Clinton, who saw the graphic details of his alleged affairs emerge in an independent counsel's report. On Tuesday, as the New York court broke for lunch, Biden's motorcade returned to the White House. By 2 p.m., Trump was back in the courtroom, and Biden was in the Oval Office. Trump's lawyers asked for a mistrial, but New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan said it was not warranted. While he conceded that some of the testimony from the adult film star was surprising, "I think the witness was a little difficult to control," he said the defense attorneys could have objected to more of it. Biden, meanwhile, was meeting with Romanian President Klaus Iohannis, speaking about the strength of NATO and joking that he had supported Romania's membership in the alliance back when I was a senator 180 years ago. Biden ignored the shouted questions from reporters, unlike when Iohannis joined Trump in the Oval Office nearly 5 years ago, and Trump held court for more than 30 minutes. "I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty," Trump said at the time. On Tuesday afternoon, it was Trump who was largely silent, as he watched a legal drama unfold in a room controlled not by him, but by a judge. Leaving the courthouse, he told reporters that the day had been a disaster for prosecutors and lamented having to sit through the proceedings. "I should be out campaigning right now," he said. Later on Tuesday afternoon, Biden met with chief executives from various industries to discuss the global economy. And we will be moving on from that article. And this one is under economic policy. The headline, "Trump advisors explore vast new legal powers for global trade war." This is written by Jeff Stein. Donald Trump's economic advisors are eyeing aggressive new legal justifications to impose tariffs on all imports, seeking to buttress a second-term plan that would reshape the U.S. economy, according to public and private comments by top aides. On the campaign trail, Trump has repeatedly promised to enact a ring around the U.S. economy by enacting a tariff of at least 10% on goods imported from any other nation. Trump's plan would target more than $3 trillion in annual imports and risks sending inflation soaring in what probably would prove the biggest escalation of trade hostilities in decades, ratcheting up the standoffs that marked his first term. But the Constitution gives power over both taxation and regulation of foreign commerce to Congress, which complicates the extent to which the president can impose tariffs through executive action. Excuse me one moment. Robert E. Lighthizer, Trump's top trade counselor, has said publicly that the former president could invoke one of two legal theories to justify a universal tariff on all U.S. trading partners. Some Trump allies are concerned these efforts would not pass legal scrutiny, though, and have in recent weeks tried to find other bases for the plan, according to GOP policy analyst Doug Holtz-Eakin, as well as four additional people familiar with the matter. Quoting, "Trump said it, and so now his advisors are all trying to figure out how to make it work legally," said Holtz-Eakin, president of the American Action Forum, a conservative think tank. Holtz-Eakin said he has spoken to several Trump advisors over the past several weeks about their efforts to design a framework for implementing the new tariff policy in the face of legal challenges. Quoting, "It's a live option. Some of his advisors think it's a great idea, and some just say, he's the boss, and we'll have to figure out a way to do this." Trump spokesman Jason Miller denied that any Trump officials or advisors are working on a legal strategy to implement his trade agenda, expressing confidence the former president would have plenty of legal tools available if he wins. There is no evidence Trump has personally signed off or reviewed any of the plans under discussion. The claim that President Trump's advisors have been working recently to craft a legal strategy to implement his trade agenda is false, and anyone stating otherwise does not speak for President Trump or his campaign, Miller said in a statement. Continuing the quote, "President Trump and his team have a wealth of experience on this issue, and they are already confident that President Trump will have a wide range of tools, options, and authorities at his disposal." Miller also referred to a December campaign statement, noting that no aspect of policy statements could be considered official unless they came from Trump or from authorized spokespeople. Although most economists believe the cost of tariffs is borne by U.S. consumers because companies typically raise prices to match them, Trump declared the import duties of his first term an unmitigated success and has vowed to expand the policy massively in a second term. Trump's advisors have divergent views on the purpose of his aggressive trade proposals. GOP allies on Wall Street and among the business elite see his rhetoric as a negotiating tactic aimed at winning concessions from trading partners, such as more favorable conditions for U.S. exports. Other Trump advisors believe more lasting trade restrictions are necessary to achieve a fundamental rebalancing of the U.S. economy, as the key to revive domestic manufacturing and insulate production from unfair foreign practices. The former president has given hints of holding both worldviews in his interviews, but there is little doubt his plans would prove extremely disruptive to the global economy. President Biden has largely left Trump's tariffs intact thus far, and Democrats supported many of Trump's trade initiatives during his first term. In addition to the 10% universal tariff, Trump has proposed pushing import duties on China as high as 60%. That could raise prices on more than $5 trillion in goods between 2026 and 2035, while also bringing in an additional $2 trillion in government revenue, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a Washington think tank. Asked about the 10% tariff proposal, Trump told Time in an interview published last week, quote, "It may be more than that." He added, "I call it a ring around the country. We have a ring around the country. A lot of people say, oh, that's going to be a tax on us. I don't believe that. I think it's a tax on the country that's doing it." The Center for American Progress, a center-left think tank, has found the 10% tariff would cost roughly $1,500 each year for the typical U.S. household. Trump has also threatened a 100% tariff on any imports of electric vehicles made in Mexico by Chinese firms, despite the trade agreement he reached with Mexico and Canada in 2018. Much of Trump's economic agenda requires congressional approval, including his plan to expand the 2017 tax cuts enacted during his first term. But there is little doubt he could substantially raise tariffs on China or place aggressive tariffs on specific imported products, such as steel, without fear of judicial intervention. Excuse me. His plan for a universal tariff on all imports, however, rests on shakier legal ground. Lighthizer, the Trump trade advisor, previously told the New York Times that he believes two separate laws could form the basis of Trump's universal tariff idea. But experts, including many former Trump officials, see problems with both, prompting advisors to mull the best approach. And that will be the end of this particular reading from me today, ladies and gentlemen. Please have a nice day and be well.
TikTok files court challenge to U.S. law that could lead to ban. TikTok and its parent company, ByteDance, challenged the U.S. government in a legal filing Tuesday over a new law forcing the sale or ban of the social media giant, igniting a high-stakes court battle in Washington. that could prove to be an existential fight for one of the world's most popular apps. President Biden signed a law last month demanding that China-based ByteDance sell TikTok within a year or be banned across the United States, arguing that the Chinese government could use the app to spy on Americans or secretly shape public opinion. But the companies in their petition for review contend that the law violates the First Amendment rights of its 170 million U.S. accounts in an extraordinary and unconstitutional assertion of power based on vaguely expressed national security concerns. Banning TikTok is so obviously unconstitutional, in fact, that even the act's sponsors recognized that reality, and therefore have tried mightily to depict the law not as a ban at all, but merely a regulation of TikTok's ownership, the challenge states. In reality, there is no choice, it adds. A forced sale is simply not possible, not commercially, not technologically, not legally. The case will set up a showdown for the Biden administration, which has touted the law as a way to avoid the pitfalls that doomed the Trump administration's previous attempt to ban the app. A loss in court for the government could set back years of backroom federal strategizing that produced one of the few national technology policies passed by Congress in two decades. A win would force a change in control over the biggest foreign-owned tech platform to achieve mainstream prominence in the United States, disrupting what has become a potent force in the online creator economy and a popular driver of American entrepreneurship and entertainment. ByteDance, a private company that valued itself last year at $268 billion, has vowed to fight what it calls an unconstitutional government overreach. "We aren't going anywhere," TikTok chief executive Shao Zi-Chu said in a TikTok video last month. "The facts and the Constitution are on our side." The Justice Department declined to comment. In its 67-page petition for review of the law's constitutionality, filed against Attorney General Merrick Garland, TikTok and ByteDance argue that the law would give the government unprecedented power to control or dismantle a speech platform it dislikes. It also challenges the government for targeting TikTok and ByteDance by name in the law, as opposed to passing broader tech regulations for privacy or transparency that would cover the industry at large. If Congress can do this, it can circumvent the First Amendment by invoking national security and ordering the publisher of any individual newspaper or website to sell to avoid being shut down, the filing says. Congress has never before crafted a two-tiered speech regime with one set of rules for one named platform and another set of rules for everyone else. The United States has yet to show evidence that China has collected TikTok's user data for espionage or skewed its recommendation algorithm for propaganda, though the law's sponsors have said the possibility of future influence is cause enough for aggressive action. TikTok and ByteDance contend that the government has acted not with any proof of a compelling interest, but on speculative and analytically flawed concerns about data security and content manipulation, concerns that, even if grounded in fact, could be addressed through far less restrictive and more narrowly tailored means. The companies also claim that the government did not engage seriously with TikTok's efforts to assuage national security concerns, including its $2 billion plan, known as Project Texas, to safeguard Americans' user data in a U.S. subsidiary closely overseen by federal authorities. The companies said they made extraordinary commitments as part of a 90-page draft national security agreement that would have given the government the authority to shut TikTok down if the companies violated the agreement. Congress tossed this tailored agreement aside in favor of the politically expedient and punitive approach of targeting for disfavor one publisher and speaker, the challenge states. Extracting TikTok from the company that has developed and managed it, the challenge says, would be infeasible given the platform's technical underpinnings, including its globally produced library of videos, its interwoven network of data centers, and its integrated systems for video editing, promotion, and moderation. China has also vowed to use its export controls to block the sale of TikTok's backbone, its video recommendation algorithm, which would force any new buyer to rebuild a critical component that many in Silicon Valley have spent years working to emulate. The platform consists of millions of lines of software code that have been painstakingly developed by thousands of engineers over multiple years, the challenge says. Such a fundamental re-architecting is not remotely feasible under a 270-day deadline. The challenge notes a fact that it says undermines the claim that the platform poses an actual threat to Americans, that Biden's campaign continues to use TikTok even after the law was signed. The Washington Post reported on Sunday that Trump's campaign also is discussing whether to create an account. The challenge also seeks to use Congress members' words against it, noting that the law's supporters said they were also motivated by their distaste for the videos on the platform related to the Israel-Gaza war and other issues, a content-specific decision that First Amendment scholars say could weaken the government's case. What's more, the challenge says, it would force the TikTok U.S. platform to become an island where Americans would have an experience detached from the rest of the world. TikTok sued the United States in 2020 and won, with a district judge in D.C. saying then-President Donald Trump's ban order had overstepped its legal bounds. A federal judge in Pennsylvania later that year sided with TikTok creators over administration officials, and a third federal judge in Montana last year said the state's TikTok ban violates the Constitution in more ways than one. But TikTok has never fought in the court it's overstepping into, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, the main venue for appeals of administrative and constitutional law. The law designated the high-level appeals court as the exclusive jurisdiction for any challenge, meaning a loss for TikTok can only be overturned by the Supreme Court. And while Trump's executive order was grounded in an ill-fitting 1977 law expanding the president's power over international commerce during a national emergency, TikTok and ByteDance must grapple with a law drafted specifically with help from Justice Department officials intended to help it survive legal assault. The companies are asking that the law's enforcement be halted until the challenge is resolved, but such injunctions are not guaranteed. ByteDance's current sale deadline is January 19th, a day before the presidential inauguration, though the government could grant a 90-day extension if it declares progress on a sale is underway. The legal challenge is being led by Eric Anderson, a former Microsoft attorney who worked as ByteDance's general counsel during its past legal skirmishes and represented the company in its negotiations with federal officials before the law was passed. Underscoring the severity of the fight, ByteDance said Anderson will shift into a new role as special counsel, focused exclusively on driving the company's effort to overturn the unconstitutional ban legislation in the U.S. The Trump administration had appealed the district court freeze of its TikTok ban in 2020 to the D.C. Circuit, where the new challenge will be tried. But the Biden administration, upon taking power in 2021, asked the court to dismiss the government's appeals, saying it wanted to establish a more deliberative process than the Trump orders that one official said then hadn't been implemented in the soundest fashion. Some legal scholars said TikTok will have a solid case in arguing that the government failed to consider potential resolutions for its concerns that wouldn't be so disruptive to Americans' rights of free expression. But others suspect the new effort could succeed because of its firmer legal footing and the court's traditional deference to the legislative branch on national security threats, even in cases involving restrictions of speech. The D.C. Circuit in 2018 said Congress was within its rights to ban software by Russia-based cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Lab from federal devices, siding with the government's claims of protecting American security and overruling the company's complaints that the move was targeted punishment. TikTok, and ByteDance's challenge is expected to be joined later by separate legal action from TikTok creators, who could contend, as they have in previous cases, that the government would block them from an important channel for small businesses and self-expression. Free speech groups are also expected to lend their support to the company's challenge. The Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University filed a brief late Monday supporting the legal challenge to Montana's TikTok ban, writing that the practice of restricting citizens' access to information, ideas, and media from abroad is one that has historically been associated with repressive regimes. Moving on to other technical issues. How a Connecticut middle school won the battle against cell phones. Manchester, Connecticut. When Raymond Dolphin became assistant principal of a middle school in Connecticut 2 years ago, it was clear to him that the kids were not all right. The problem was cell phones. Students were using the devices in class, despite a rule against it. Social media was exacerbating nearly every conflict among students. When Dolphin walked the hallways or surveyed the cafeteria, he invariably saw heads bent over screens. So in December, Dolphin did something unusual. He banned them. The experiment at Illing Middle School sparked objections from students and some parents, but it has already generated profound and unexpected results. Dolphin likened prohibiting cell phones to curbing consumption of sugary foods. In a matter of months, you start feeling better, he said. What unfolded at the school reflects a broader struggle underway in education, as some administrators turn to increasingly drastic measures to limit the reach of a technology that is both ubiquitous and endlessly distracting. Scores of schools across the country, from California to Indiana to Pennsylvania, have taken similar steps to remove cell phones altogether rather than rely on rules around their use. Those decisions come amid rising bipartisan alarm over the ways cell phones and social media may be harming children, concerns that have led to warnings from the U.S. Surgeon General and the Health Commissioner of New York City. About a third of U.S. teens report that they use social media site almost constantly. Dolphin, 45, wears rectangular glasses and carries a walkie-talkie in his belt. He became a teacher right out of college, made a detour into banking, then returned to education a decade ago. It's only in recent years that the presence of phones at school has become overwhelming, he said. When a fellow educator in nearby Hartford recommended a way to blunt their impact, Dolphin jumped at it. At 7:50 on a March morning, Dolphin hustled toward his usual spot near the school entrance to make sure the system was working. Moments later, more than 800 middle school students, some boisterous, some sleepy, began flowing through the doors in a river of bulky backpacks and puffy jackets. Those who had cell phones in their hands slipped them into individual gray pouches made of synthetic rubber. They clicked the magnetic lock at the top of their pouches shut, then placed them into their backpacks or held them up to show teachers. The pouches would stay with them, locked, until dismissal at 2:45 p.m. Introducing the pouches, made by a California-based company called Yonder, was no cakewalk. Many students arriving that morning said they were still sore. "I cried," said Michael Wilson, 14, about when he learned his phone would become inaccessible during the school day. He signed a last-ditch petition posted on the cafeteria wall urging the administration to reconsider. Shioma Brown, in a gray sweatsuit and Crocs, slid her cell phone with a glittery cover into her pouch and locked it. She, too, was mad at first. As time passed, her feelings have shifted. "You can focus more on classes," she said. "These days, she sometimes forgets that she has her phone with her." Teachers who were initially skeptical that the pouches would work say they've been transformative. Dan Connolly, an eighth-grade science teacher, said he used to repeat the same reminder at the start of each period 6 times a day. "Put away your cell phones and take out your headphones." "Now the first thing I say is, good morning, not take your AirPods out," Connolly said. It's not as though Illing has allowed cell phone use in class previously. Like 3/4 of all U.S. schools, it didn't. But such policies rely on individual teachers to carry them out, making them effectively an unenforceable wish. In the words of Jonathan Haidt, a psychologist at New York University who was called for banning phones from schools. Justin Pistorius, a math teacher at Illing, said that enforcing the prior no cell phone policy led to power struggles with students who frequently complained. They would say, "Why are you the dude that's doing this? The lady last year let us use them. You're the jerk," Pistorius said. At first, using a word other than jerk. Enter Yonder, a company founded in 2014 whose magnetically locking pouches are also used to store cell phones during concerts, theatrical events, and professional exams. Lately, though, its sales to schools have exploded. Last year, the number of U.S. schools using the pouches rose to 2,000, said company spokesperson Sarah Leader, more than double the figure in 2022. Schools from Manhattan to rural Texas have bought the pouches and distributed them to students. In Providence, Rhode Island, all six of the city's middle schools and two of its high schools, a total of 4,500 students, are now using them. Some educators turned to the pouches out of desperation. When students returned to school full-time after learning remotely during the pandemic, their relationship to their phones had changed dramatically, said Carol Kruser, who was then principal at Chicopee High School in Massachusetts. Instead of checking their phones at lunch, they were watching YouTube videos in class and refusing to put away the devices, Kruser said. Teachers were begging for help. Kruser induced Yonder pouches at her high school in the spring of 2021. "I really wasn't sure if it was going to be career suicide," said Kruser, 55, who is now an assistant superintendent in Chicopee. "I just thought it was that important." Fast forward 3 years, the use of the pouches has spread to neighboring school districts. This past fall, Massachusetts even launched a grant program to pay for them. "We have these devices which we know are, at best, habit-forming, and at worst, addictive, that are increasingly linked to depression and loneliness," said Susan Lin, a psychologist, lecturer at Harvard Medical School, and author of Who's Raising the Kids? "So why would we have them in schools?" At Illing, Dolphin presented the idea to the principal and the district leadership this past fall. Both were enthusiastic, and the school spent $31,000 to buy the equipment. Parents and students proved harder to persuade. Objections from parents fell into three main categories. Some worried about reaching their children in an emergency. A small number had children struggling with anxiety who used their cell phones to listen to music or access meditation apps. Others just liked the convenience of being in touch with their children during the day. The school reminded parents that there is at least one landline phone in every classroom, and in many cases, two. Teachers also still have their cell phones in case they need to call 911. The pouches also are not bank vaults, Dolphin added, and can be cut open in any emergency. In the worst-case scenario, a school shooting, students should focus on hiding and staying quiet, Dolphin said. The whole idea that you want every kid to be taking out a phone and calling parents is the exact opposite of the safety protocols, he said. For the handful of children who relied on their cell phones to manage anxiety, Illing created a weaning-off plan. Those students could come to a school office where administrators would unlock their pouches. Within weeks, it was no longer necessary. That'll take us to the end of this week's Washington Post. Trip and Bill and I will be back next Wednesday. Take care until then.